Hello, and thank you for downloading this episode of Radio Grimbald from RadioGrimbald.com. I'm your host, Goldine Ogawa, and welcome to the second ever episode of Radio Grimbald. For those of you joining this show already in progress, I am Goldine Ogawa, and I am a writer. And what I do here is I read the stories that I've written. This week, I'm going to be reading two stories, which will... I think that's going to be kind of unusual. I'm generally going to try to keep this podcast for one story per episode, but one of these stories is very, very short, and if it got an episode all to itself, it would be kind of a, you know, a bum episode. So I've decided, instead of having like a really, really short 5-minute episode, I'm just going to put it in here with another story, and I think it works because these two stories, they do kind of go together, even though they've got nothing, you know, they don't share any characters or storyline. They're not part of a series. But they do kind of stylistically go together. They have similar themes. And so I think they go together fairly well. Now, the theme that ties them together, of course, is vampires. And as I warned you all last week, I'm not good with doing traditional vampires. Vampires, for me, they're kind of in that awkward space, you know, between horror and fantasy. Now, of course, vampires work very, very well with horror because, you know, they're these fanged, blood-drinking, undead people, you know. You can do all sorts of things with vampires in horror stories. Because in horror stories, the main character is not allowed superpowers of their own, unless we're talking about Buffy. But anyway, the thing about vampires is, yeah, very, very scary monsters, frightening. Distinctly less frightening when they're in a world that also has dragons, or wizards that can shoot fireballs out of their hands, you know. When that happens, when you have creatures and characters who have those capabilities, suddenly, you know, a vampire, however frightening they are at night, you know, they're highly combustible. That's a theme that pretty much stretches across all known types of vampire genre, you know. So my problem with vampires is I write fantasy. I don't dabble in this horror stuff, and it's not my thing. I'm sure that, you know, there are people who like horror, and that's fine. But I could never get into horror because I never thought it was fair that, you know, the bad guys have all these superpowers, but the good guys don't. I don't get that. And so if I'm going to do stories with vampires, they're going to have to be in fantasy land, which means there's going to be, you know, they're going to be frightening. They're more frightening than the average person. But they nevertheless exist in a world in which there are other creatures that are more frightening than vampires and who might not necessarily like vampires that much. And so you immediately start taking them down a peg a bit. They're not these, you know, spooky, frightening things so much anymore. They're spooky and frightening, but that dragon is about to roast them to a crisp, and that's the thing we're actually worried about, you know? So when I was faced with the prospect of writing, I wanted to write some vampire stories. And I was faced with, you know, well, how do I make vampires believable in a fantasy settings? Well, there's two ways you can go about it, I think. The first way is you can scale the vampires back up. You can give them more powers, make them more frightening, make them sort of scale them up so that they can compete with the dragons and the wizards and the elves and the people who are inhabiting Fantasyland. And I like that. I like that method. I always feel like if you have a problem that is a problem of scale, vampires aren't exactly on the same scale as dragons. It's better to scale up. It's better to scale the vampires up so they can compete with the dragons than scale the dragons down so they're just glorified lizards. That's just not fun. And that's what leads us into the first story, the very short story that I wrote. It's called The Bells of Aesvi, and it's kind of a ghost story, and it's about a vampire character that I created, whose name is Amstrass. And she is, as vampires go, kind of the big burrito. I'm sorry, I haven't had lunch yet. She's the big deal. She's sort of the big legend. in my own world, kind of comparable to Dracula. Dracula is sort of the bar by which all other vampires are measured. And so this was a story that I wrote. Actually, it began as a piece of backstory for Amstrass. Amstrass appears in a novel I wrote, which is coming out next year. And this piece of backstory was just something that I wrote kind of offhand as a throwaway just to kind of flesh out her character. And when I was putting together the Fiddler's Dream collection, I realized that I was kind of a few stories short of a picnic basket, and to mix my metaphors. And I pulled this one out and I kind of fleshed it out and hung it in, you know, framed it and hung it on the wall and said, oh, it'll do. So it's in there. So it very much has sort of a feel of being a puzzle piece that's been plucked out of a bigger puzzle. And so if you get that feeling listening to it, you're absolutely right. And the puzzle that it belongs to is called Lucina in the House of Madgren. It'll be out next year. But I think the story stands on its own fairly well. The Bells of Aesvi. Copyright 2011 by Goldine Ogawa. This is a story about Amstrass, the Svenian vampire who is possibly the most famous of her kind in Antalonia. It has been told and retold many times, but, unlike most of the stories surrounding her, has retained the same basic facts. This continuity can be credited to one Boragner de Felpas, who laid down the first written version from a conversation he had with a woman who claimed to be a principal character in the story and a witness to its events. And it is this original version, a summary of which can be found in chapter 14 of the novel Lucina in the House of Madgren, that has been used as a reference for the following retelling. Long ago, deep in the mountains of Svenia, there was a little town called Aesvi. Your great-great-great-great-grandfather or grandmother might have come to it if they took the west road from Ulluskas or the east road from Tivin. But if you walk that road now, you'll find it leads nowhere at all. The little town has disappeared. This is the story of how that came to pass. The town was built on a hill, and at the top of the hill there was the graveyard. It was surrounded by a high stone wall, with one high wooden gate. Inside the graveyard were many graves, and above each one, hung from a little hook on the headstone, was a bell. They had been put there so that, if someone was buried by mistake, they could ring the bell by pulling on the bit of wire that ran from the bell down into the coffin. One day, when the first chills of autumn clung to the morning air, the bells began to ring. All of them, even the old and crusted bells, whose wires had rusted away to nothing generations ago, shook off their coats of dirt and lichen and rang. And they rang, and they rang, and they rang. At first they rang quietly, and the people in the town of Aesvi thought they only heard the ringing of their own ears, if they heard anything at all. But with each passing day the bells rang louder and louder, and louder. Eventually they rang so loud that everyone in the little town could hear them, and no one could get any sleep at night. So after a week of this, some men went up to see what the matter was. Everyone saw them walking up the high road that led to the graveyard. They saw them unchain the high wooden gate. They saw them go inside. Then they saw them no more, for the men never came out again. And the bells continued to ring. The next day, more men went up the hill looking to see what happened to the first lot and to do something about those bells. They were all healthy, strong lads, God-fearing, and with good heads. They were never seen again. The bells kept ringing. They began to sound insistent, impatient, even. More men went up the hill and disappeared into the graveyard, and the bells of the graveyard of Aesvi kept on ringing. Eventually, it got so that there were no more young men in the village. Then the young women, intent on getting their husbands and brothers back, began going up the hill. They brought with them knives and flaming torches and holy arrows, and never went in groups less than five. Group by group, they too disappeared into the graveyard and were never seen again. Aesvi acquired a sinister reputation, and many of the remaining men and women left the town. They were never seen again, either. And all the while the bells rang on. It got so that even the deaf old men and women could not sleep at night, and, having lost their sons and daughters, they heaved themselves out of bed or out of their comfortable armchairs, and together went tottering slowly up the hill. But when they reached the high wooden gate of the graveyard, they found it shut, grown over with ivy and with nettles and with thorns. The bells sounded angry, and it frightened them. So the grandmothers and grandfathers of the town came back down the hill, climbed back into bed and back into their comfortable armchairs. The next morning, they were all dead. It is said that they died of disappointment. The few travelers who were passing through Aesvi quickly left, or tried to. When they took the west road, they found it bent around and turned into the east road and led right back to the town. Finding themselves trapped, they too went up to the graveyard to try and stop the bells ringing. Whether they found the gate grown over, no one knows. But they were never seen again, either. And then, there was no one left in Aesvi but the children. Babes barely out of the crib, toddlers and 10-year-olds, and a couple of young teenagers. And on the morning when there was no one left but the children, then finally, the bells ceased to ring. There was one moment of deathly silence, and then a music spread throughout the town. It came from the graveyard, and it was the most beautiful and unearthly music there ever was. It drew the frightened and tear-stained children out onto the street, and then up, out of the village. The older ones carried the younger, and the middle ones skipped and danced. They came to the high gate of the graveyard, and they found it open, with no sign of vines, or of nettles, or of thorns. From within came the music, and they could glimpse a pleasant green garden, warm and filled with sunlight, with soft green grass, and many good things to eat, laid out on white blankets. All at once the children forgot their mothers and fathers who had been lost. They forgot their grandparents, who had died. All they saw was the beautiful garden, and all they heard was the beautiful music. And together, they all rushed inside. All the children, except one. She was the last to go. She was the last because she had a bad leg and limped slowly. She also had one blind eye, which made it difficult for her to navigate crowds. But having only one eye, she had gotten into the habit of looking at her surroundings more carefully, and she alone noticed what the other children had missed in their hurry to get into the garden. There was a woman standing by the gate. It was she who held it open. She was a tall woman, taller than any man the little girl had seen. She wore a long red dress, and she had long straw-colored hair. She had a pale face and a dark smile, and she beckoned the little girl when she saw her looking. "You're a clever thing," the woman said. She had a voice like frost on dead grass. "What is your name?" The girl told the strange woman her name. The woman smiled, showing long, sharp teeth and a wicked tongue. "I am Amstrass," she said. Then she gave the girl a pair of good shoes, for the girl was barefoot, and a warm cloak. Her clothes were in tatters, and a small purse with many different shaped coins inside. Finally, she leaned forward and popped a small glass marble into the girl's empty eye socket. While the girl was blinking and weeping, for the glass was cold and did not feel pleasant, she heard the woman, Amstrass, give her instructions. "You will turn around, walk down the hill, through the village, and away. I have unbent the roads. They will take you to other towns now. You must not stop or look back until you come to the next village. Then you are free to do as you wish. But you must always remember to tell your story to whomever you meet." As the woman spoke, the girl rubbed her eye and blinked away her tears. When she looked up, she found with astonishment that she could see with both eyes now, and furthermore that she could see with her glass eye what had been hidden from her living one. The graveyard was no garden. It was a dead and barren waste, with the gravestones all knocked over and the trees bent and withered. About the place were littered the bodies of the townsfolk, all dead and in various stages of decay. Some of them looked to have been mauled by a wild animal. There was no sign whatsoever of the children. But the girl remembered her instructions, and she turned around and left. She did not look back, but she heard the graveyard gate swing shut behind her with a crash. The little girl followed the instructions to the letter, and on her second day of walking she came to Tivin and told the astonished and horrified people there her story. Many of them decided to go and see this deserted town for themselves, but when they tried, they found the road disappeared into dark forests, and no matter how they searched, they could never find the town of Aesvi again. But the little girl continued to tell her story throughout her long life, and the tale of Amstrass eventually spread across the country. And even today, some travelers report, on lonely, frosty mornings in remote places of the mountains, you can sometimes hear the faint tinkle of a bell, and the even fainter tinkle of a child's laughter. And the wise ones will say, "Those are the bells of Aesvi. Do not listen to their music." And that is the end of that. And there you have the bells of Aesvi. Like I said, it is a puzzle piece. And the puzzle, as it were, is the novel Lucina in the House of Madgrin, which has a lot more of Amstrass. And you get to see what she's really capable of. So that's one way of putting vampires into a Fantasyland setting, sort of giving them more powers so that they can sort of compete with the other inhabitants so that they continue to be these mystical, scary beings. Of course, the flip side of that is that vampires, you put them in Fantasyland where there are these more powerful people, and they become distinctly vulnerable. And you can really kind of pull the rug out from them and turn the table on them and have these fun stories where you realize that vampires, far from being the villains, even if they are admittedly nasty people, kind of take on sort of an underdog role, and you start to realize that vampires are the ones you worry about. You worry about what's going to happen to them if they were to come across one of those people who is in fact more powerful than they are. And it was exploring ideas along those lines that led me to write the next story that I'm reading here. It's called Nobody's Road, and I wrote it actually as a Christmas present for my mother. I thought it would be fun to try writing a Christmas-themed ghost story. And I don't know how successful I was. Nobody's Road. Copyright 2011 by Goldine Ogawa. Thank you.
In a place to the north, there was a house in a wood where it was thought no one lived. The road that led to it was narrow and always covered in leaves, except in winter, when it was covered in snow, and the trees all around had their branches bent as though they were in pain. Nobody ever went to the house, because if you entered that wood at night, you never came back. There was only one road that ran through the wood, between the town to the west and the village in the east. Nobody walked that road, either, not if they could help it. There was another road that went around the wood to the south, and everyone took that. It was longer and led up and down over hills, but the people who traveled it did not disappear. One winter twilight, at the crossroads outside the town, there stood a man with a map in his hands. He had come a long way that day from a place very far away, and was going to spend the holidays with his family in the East Village. He was tired of walking and did not like the idea of going out of his way. So he checked his map. The map said that there were two roads, one to the south, which skirted the edge of the wood, and one to the east, which ran right through it. The map had been made by people who did not live in the area, and so the map did not tell about the other road in the forest, the road covered in leaves that led to a house where it was thought no one lived. If there had been a local farmer about, or a gossiper, or even a troublemaker, they would have told the man not to go through the wood. They would have made sure he didn't. They would have told him that nobody walked down nobody's road. But there were none. So the man picked up his parcels and walked into the wood. Night came early in the wood, and shadows which had spent the day hiding under toadstools crept out onto the road. The man cursed, for he had brought no light. In the darkness of the trees he could hear a rattling, tapping, like something on long, sharp legs running over hard bark. The man was not fanciful, but for some reason he thought of spiders. Snow frosted the tops of the trees and lay in splotches on the road. In one of these, the man saw a footprint. It was recent. Then, further down the road, another. The thought of company was an attractive one, so the man hurried forward. He did not see the pair of cold blue eyes that watched him from the shadows under a tree, nor the long white hand that rested on the trunk, whose sharp, thin fingers made a rattling, tapping sound on the bark. The footprints belonged to a tall, dark stranger. He stood in the road wearing tall black boots and carrying a lantern that didn't shed much light. He smiled at the man with teeth as white as the snow.
"Greetings, traveller. What brings you to this place at such a time?"
His voice was like a pool of water in a dark, cold place, dangerous and deep.
"I come from the town to the village on the other side," the man explained.
"Why, so do I," said the stranger with a cold smile.
"Let us make the journey together, that it may pass more swiftly."
The stranger was not the man's idea of good company, but he was company nonetheless, and he didn't see much choice in the matter. He agreed.
"Tell me," said the stranger, "where do you come from? I feel I have seen you before, but I cannot say where."
"I come from away," said the man. Then he added, "I come from away across the starlit meadows, beyond the stony wall, on the other side of the shadows."
"What?" said the stranger.
There was a sharp edge in his voice that had not been there before.
"Not literally, of course," explained the man. "'Tis a saying from where I come from. Simply means, I come a long way. I don't know why you think you've seen me before, but I do look like many people."
The stranger ruminated on this a while, and in the silence he created, their footsteps crunched and shuffled through the snow and frosty leaves. After a time the man heard, or thought he heard, another pair of footsteps somewhere behind him.
Had he been alone, he would have stopped to listen, but the stranger walked on, deaf to their faint echo. Silently and smoothly, they were joined by another man. He was also tall, with tall black boots and long dark hair, and he had a face like a skull.
"Why, greetings to you, my friend," said the stranger.
The stranger's friend had a soft, silky voice, like a snake slithering through velvet. "With it," he said, "'tis a fine evening indeed. But why do you keep such company?"
"Why," said the stranger, "it is a cold and lonely night, and we souls should stick together."
"We," said the stranger's friend, "are not souls." Something passed between the two tall men, something the man with the parcel did not notice. It was like the erratic flight of a bat darting from one to the other. Then the stranger smiled wide.
"You are in luck, my fine fellow," he said, clapping the man on the shoulder. "We shall all have company tonight, which is such a rare thing these days."
"Oh, rare indeed," said the stranger's friend. "Nobody ever walks this road, save us, in the night."
"Well," said the man, "I am glad that I met you."
"We are two," said the stranger.
"Do you remember old McGibbons?" asked the stranger's friend.
"I do indeed, my friend," said the stranger. "He used to walk this road. Alas, he walks it no more."
"And our Mrs. Himble," said the stranger's friend.
"And the young Rosie Miles," said the stranger. "What happened to them all?" asked the man.
The stranger and his friend exchanged significant glances.
"They stopped coming."
"After they found little Hineas?"
"He went down this road one night," said the stranger.
"But he did not come back," said the stranger's friend.
"They found him in the morning, not 10 yards from the edge of the wood."
"Dead?" asked the man.
"Oh, yes, dead indeed," the stranger nodded. "Dead as a doornail."
"And dry as a desert," added his friend. "He didn't have a drop of blood left in his body. It had all been sucked away."
And the stranger's friend inhaled sharply as if to mime the sucking. Away and above them, a lone owl hooted, calling out a warning to the walkers or a greeting to its mate. Without thinking, the man walked a little faster.
"But did you know," remarked the stranger, "old McGibbons did come back one last time?"
"Did he now?" asked his friend. "What happened?"
"He met me," replied the stranger. "So I took him home."
"How fortunate," said his friend. "The same happened with our Mrs. Himble and the young Rosie Miles, only it was I they met."
"That was very kind of you, to take them home, I mean," said the man.
"Oh, not at all," said the stranger's friend. "They were excellent company."
"But we grow lonely again," sighed the stranger. "We receive so few visitors."
The three walkers came to a branch in the road. The main road continued to the right, into the shadows spotted with snow. But to the left, the snow was piled so deep it was more like a small valley between the dark trees. The man shuddered at the sight of the trees, which were tall and twisted as though they were in pain. Without pausing in his step, he began to walk down the right-hand road.
"I wouldn't go that way, if I were you," said the stranger's friend.
The man paused.
"It is a long and lonely walk that way," added the stranger.
The man turned his head. The two strangers beckoned him with their thin white hands.
"We're not even halfway to the East Village," said the stranger. "The night goes on. The road gets darker."
"This way leads to our house," said the stranger's friend. "Not a few minutes away. Our house is bright and warm."
"It has a fire," the stranger said.
"And soft chairs," added his friend.
The man looked back along the road covered in snow. To his surprise, where before he had thought it only led to dark and twisted trees, now he saw distant lights twinkling between their branches. His mind, tired and cold, began conjuring up images of a comfortable chair pulled up by a large, warm fire. A short stop, he decided, to rest his tired feet.
"Well," he said, shuffling back toward the strangers, "perhaps a short visit?" Smiling widely, they each took him by an arm and led him away, down the road covered in snow, through the twisted trees. "No need for it to be short," said the stranger.
"Why, you could even spend the night," said his friend, "or the week. No need to get to the East Village tomorrow. No need at all."
"Indeed," said the man agreeably. "No need at all." The night grew deeper and the trees grew thicker and the road sank deep in the snow. But this proved no impedance to the strangers, who gladly helped the man through the larger drifts. "Never mind the cold," said the stranger. "When we reach our house, we shall have the finest warm drink to be shared."
"Indeed," agreed his friend. "The best thing to drink in the world."
The house was larger and darker than the man had expected when at last they reached it. Only two of its windows were alight, giving it the appearance of a giant, dark face with small, flickering eyes. But the man had little time to reflect on the reality of the house versus his imagined one, for the stranger still had him by the arms, and they propelled him up the drive into the front door. It opened at their approach, yawning like a black mouth, and the man stumbled inside. Behind him, the door shut with a snap and a crunch. Inside, the strangers led the man up to a room where all the windows had been boarded up, and a single candle flickered on a table covered in lace. Beside the table was a tall armchair, and this the man sank into with a sigh of relief, for his legs were tired from being made to walk so fast.
"A fire, perhaps?" commanded the stranger, and his friend went to the hearth and knelt before it.
There he made shuffling sounds for a few moments, and when he stepped away, a warm and crackling fire filled the grate.
"And now for something to drink," said the stranger's friend. "I am thirsty. Are you thirsty?"
"I am indeed," agreed the stranger.
"So am I," said the man. But the strangers did not seem to hear him. One went to a cabinet on the far side of the room and returned with two crystal wine glasses in his thin white hands. The other reached into his black coat and retrieved a sharp, naked knife.
"I am," the man repeated, eyeing the knife nervously, "rather thirsty." "I should not be surprised," said the stranger.
"Fear does tend to dry the mouth," added his friend.
"And there will be drink aplenty,
but not for you."
And the strangers smiled at the man, their long, sharp teeth glinting in the firelight. The man looked from one to the other. He looked at the wine glasses. He looked at the knife. He looked at their hands and their fingers and their long, sharp teeth. Lastly, he looked them in their luminous eyes, and then he, too, smiled. It was a smile that revealed yellow, crooked teeth, and there was not a drop of amusement in it. Then he stood up.
to the strangers, it appeared as though the man that had been sitting in the chair before them had been shrugged off like an overcoat, and someone else had stood up out of him. The man who stood before them now was tall, taller than either of them, wearing robes so black they looked as though a patch of night had stolen into the room. This new man looked at them from under bushy eyebrows, out of a frame of ragged hair as black and fierce as rain at night, with dark eyes that glittered. His face was so pale it looked more blue than white, and with his long twisted nose he appeared to always be snarling. The man raised one gnarled blue hand, palm up, and he smiled. His teeth were still yellow and crooked, but there was triumph in his dark eyes. "That will be quite enough," he said, in a voice so quiet it could have been whispered into a child in bed, but so sharp it could have cut ice, and so piercing that it echoed around the room. "Enough of that, indeed," he said, and turned his hand over, closing it into a fist. "Your story is over." The strangers, the tall vampires in black, doubled over, cracked, crumbled, and finally turned to dust and ash. The wine glasses shattered and the naked knife hit the floor with a muted thunk. The blue man stood alone in the room. He put his blue, gnarled hands into the pockets of his night-black robes. He looked sternly at first the fire, then the candle, which in turn went out. Then he turned around and marched briskly from the room. He went back, down the stairs, and the door crumbled to dust before him as he left the house. Outside, the winter world was cloaked in snow, which glittered under the light of countless shining stars. The moon, which had been hiding on the horizon, now peeked up over the treetops and smiled at the blue man, who smiled back. He took one last look around the clearing. Then there was a gust of frigid winter wind, and the clearing was empty, save for the snow and the starlight, and the faint sound of someone laughing the contented, happy laugh of a job well done. Today there is no house there, and the trees have untwisted themselves into better, more comfortable shapes. Nobody's road through the wood can be travelled safely, day or night, and the road that once led to the house is so rutted and overgrown that it can hardly be called a road at all. Still, even if you do stumble your way down it, and even if you do come to the place where the house once was, all you will find is a clearing full of leaves and some old trees. And if you are lucky, and it is a clear winter night, you might find the tall blue man, the one with hair like dark rain and a twisted nose. But all he will do is smile and shake his head, turn you around, and send you home again. The end. The man, well, he's not really a man, but you probably guessed that on your own. His name is Fearbright, and he also shows up in Lucina in the House of Madryn. Did I mention that I wrote a novel called Lucina in the House of Madryn? It's coming out next year. Both these stories, however, are part of a collection called Fiddler's Dream and Other Stories that is already out. And if you're a listener in the US, the UK, France, or Germany, you can buy it on Amazon in the Kindle store for your Kindle or whatever device running the Kindle app. If you're in the US, UK, France, Germany, Canada, or Australia, you can buy it on iTunes for your iPad, iPhone, or whatever device running the iBooks app. Because, yeah, it's an ebook. You can search for it on the Amazon Kindle store, the iTunes iBook store, or you can go to my website, goldeneogawa.com. That's G-O-L-D-E-E-N
OGAWA.com and look under the books tab, and I've got this wonderful directory that I made with all the books that are up and where you can buy them. Next week on the podcast, I'll be reading another story from the Fiddler's Dream collection. It's called Sandals and Sword, and it's about what happens when the heroines in fairy tales get tired of being the damsels in distress and decide to fight back. And that about wraps up this episode. If you have any suggestions, comments, questions, or concerns for the podcast or me, you can email me at my name, Goldeen Ogawa. I'll spell that for you once again. GoldeenOgawa@gmail.com. And if you like the podcast, it is now listed on iTunes. It's so exciting. If you go to iTunes and just search on either my name or Radio Grimbald, it should come right up. So no need to go through the website, although it's cool if you do that. You can also just go to iTunes and subscribe in iTunes, and iTunes will deliver the podcast to you fresh every Tuesday, straight to your home computer or iOS device or Android phone. I don't care what platform you're on, just so long as you're listening. Now, before I go, I really should say special thanks for their help in the production of Radio Grimbald go out to Marion Goldeen, my wonderful mother, Evan Ogawa, and Rachel Goldeen for creating the theme music, and of course, to you for listening. Radio Grimbald is written, performed, edited, and just about everything else by me, Goldeen Ogawa. Find out more on the web at radiogrimbald.com and goldeenogawa.com. Thank you for listening, and until next week, take care and have fun.